One of the just huge highlights of being here is getting to spend a little time, I wish it was more, with Jimmy, and the gift of friendship, there is nothing like it, and it overcomes every barrier. I was thinking, y'all know there's a debate on tonight, an election going on, and Jimmy and I don't always see eye to eye politically. He's a deeply committed socialist, but that's never really gotten in the way of our love for each other, and oh, hey, one other announcement before I go any further. I was told, you guys all had like clickers earlier, and we're supposed to turn those in. We are 29 clickers short. And I just want to say, anybody who would come to a conference on spiritual formation and rip off a clicker is just got some issues. So let the Spirit work on you over these next moments and get those clickers in. Okay. Have you seen the Olympics this summer? Michael Phelps, amazing, isn't he? 8 gold medals. Tell you how popular he is. Guy who works with Facebook was telling me that Facebook reckoned they added 5 million users over the Olympics because Michael Phelps said that he goes on Facebook. Now, question, how many of you would say, be willing to say, I admire Michael Phelps? Would be willing to say, I admire Michael Phelps? Me too. Here's the deal. Somewhere out there this summer, there was a kid watching Michael Phelps, and what happened to him went way beyond admiration. Somewhere out there, and there really was this kid, and none of us knows who it is yet, one day we will, but somewhere out there was a kid, when he watched Michael Phelps, his heart started pounding, and his mind started racing. And he said to himself, what Michael Phelps did, I could do. The way he swam, I could swim. Where he's standing on that podium one day, I could stand. And right now, while you and I sit here, that kid is going to the pool every day. He is reading articles. He is watching videos. He is looking for a coach. He actually wants to become like Michael Phelps. He actually wants to do what Michael Phelps has done. He is not just an admirer of Michael Phelps. He's a follower. Now, I will applaud what Michael Phelps did, but it's not going to change my life. I have not been in a pool since the Olympics. I'm an admirer. I'm not a follower. There's a big difference. An admirer is impressed. A follower is devoted. An admirer applauds. A follower surrenders. An admirer approves. A follower obeys. A lot of people admired Martin Luther King. Some marched with him. Not many went to jail with him. Not many had their houses bombed as he did. A lot of people admired Mother Teresa. Not many followed her to live among the destitute and the dying. This is why we're here. It's why you have traveled to talk about what's been talked about these last 2 days. When you come to the end of the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew talks about two groups of people, and it's a dynamic that kind of runs throughout the Gospel of Matthew. Jesus begins to teach, and we're told when he saw the crowds, he went up to the mountainside. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach. Two groups, one is the crowd. And there's lots of them, and they're very impressed by Jesus. In fact, when he gets to the end of his message, we're told when Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching because he taught them as one who had authority, not as their teachers of the law. The whole crowd admired Jesus. But while he was teaching, something happened in the hearts of a few of them that went way beyond admiration. For a few, while Jesus was talking, their hearts started pounding, and their minds started racing. And something deep inside them said, this is it. This is what I have been longing for my whole life, to be cleansed and forgiven of all my sin and mess, to know God, to have courage, to have a life beyond the constant worry and fear and anxiety, to not be a slave anymore to sexual desire or money or people's approval or success, to be a part of God's work in my own little way to redeem the world, to have confidence beyond death. I must have this. I would rather have what this man has and give up everything else in the world than have everything else in the world and give up this man. Therefore, I will pay any price. I will do whatever he wants me to do. I will go wherever he tells me to go. I will be whatever he says I should be. I am leaving the crowd. I am not just an admirer. From this day on, I will live my life as a fully devoted follower of this man. And they'd go home that night and they couldn't sleep. And they'd wake up the next morning and they'd be captivated by the same thing. The whole crowd admired Jesus, but every once in a while, somebody in the crowd wakes up and crosses a line and says, I will follow. Now, of course, Jesus knew this would happen. And one of the things that Jesus is constantly doing is challenging people to move from admirer to follower. And generally, that move involves some kind of action, some price to pay, something quite concrete. John 3, you all know this story. A Pharisee named Nicodemus came to Jesus by night, said, Rabbi, we know that you're a teacher who has come from God. No one could do these miraculous things if you are not with him. John tells us he came by night, most likely because he did not want anybody to see him. And Jesus says, you must be born again. You must become my follower. You must publicly identify with me. And eventually Nicodemus does. When Jesus dies, Nicodemus publicly claims his body, places it in a tomb, becomes his follower. Sometimes people don't. Rich young ruler comes up, and the text says he fell on his knees before Jesus and says, good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life? He's an admirer. He falls to his knees. He calls him good. Jesus says, go sell everything, give the money away, and follow me. And that's the deal breaker. The rich young ruler was ready to admire him, but following, where it would interfere with his life, his financial life or security or something, that's where he drew the line. There is, in the New Testament, a kind of a natural progression as people are coming to know Jesus. They begin as strangers to him. And then from strangers, they become admirers. And then from admirers, they may become followers. And of course, at each one of those points, people may decide that they're not going to go any further. Pilate does not become an admirer. Herod does not become an admirer. Rich young ruler does not become a follower. But I think what has happened in churches, especially in America in our day, is that we have added an additional category, and that category is users of Jesus. You know, we never put it that way. But in many, many, many people's mind, there is a kind of an alternative relationship with Jesus that kind of goes like this. I want to use Jesus to get into heaven when I die. And there's a deep problem with the gospel and the way that it has been presented, because for many, many people, the gospel has become the proclamation of the minimal entrance requirements for getting into heaven when you die. Now, again, we never put it that way. But it'll go something like this. How do you know you're going to go to heaven when you die? And, of course, there's little, if any, discussion about what kind of community heaven might be and what kind of person might I need to be to actually enjoy being in heaven. It's just thought of in this cartoon way as kind of the pleasure factory and hell is kind of the torture chamber. And how do you know you're going to get into the pleasure factory? Because God's going to get people out. And the gospel is, you've been trying to earn your way in, so don't do that anymore. Get on the grace plan. Believe the right stuff about an arrangement that has been made for you, and then you have obeyed the minimal entrance requirements for getting into heaven when you die.
And then you become a user of Jesus. And of course, there's no intrinsic connection then to being a disciple, to being a follower. Talking in this session about, is your church producing followers of Jesus, disciples, or just Christians, commonly understood? A Christian, as commonly understood, I think, is somebody who identifies with a religious subculture. So, you know, this is our team, and then the Buddhists are another team, and the Muslims are another team, and we like it when more people join our team. It's somebody who believes they're going to heaven when they die because they accepted an arrangement to get them in. But discipleship, making a serious intention to obey everything Jesus said, making a serious intention to do what Jesus said to do, is treated as largely an option. Kind of extra credit. And churches are full of this kind of Christian. And then church leaders who spend a lot of time trying to remotivate or re-excite them so that the church can be successful. And it gets tiring for everybody. It is interesting, I think, that the New Testament uses the word Christian only twice. And it actually originated as kind of a derisive nickname. It uses the word disciple 268 times. It's a lot easier to make a Christian, commonly understood. But the New Testament is a book about disciples. And I want to locate the difference a little more precisely when we talk about disciples. I think what I'd like to ask you to do, if you don't mind, just for about 10 seconds or so, because I want to talk about what kind of faith characterizes a disciple. Turn to the person next to you. There's a phrase that we use in the church, saving faith. There's a phrase, saving faith. How would you define that term, saving faith? Would you turn to the person next to you for just a moment? Just take 10 or 20 seconds. How do you understand the phrase, saving faith? All right, hold that thought in mind, and we'll come back to that in a couple moments. When we talk about faith, one of the things that has troubled me a lot is, how can two people affirm the same beliefs, you know, recite the Apostles' Creed or whatever together, believe the same stuff, and yet one of them is loving and courageous and truthful and generous and winsome. And the other one, and everybody kind of knows, is unloving, severe, judgmental, kind of greedy, arrogant. And yet they would both say that they believe the same things. How does that happen? Well, to get into that, I want to talk about three different forms of faith or three different kinds of conviction. This is part of what I get into in Faith and Doubt. And it's a little tricky to teach out. So if I lose you at all in this talk, I will lose you in the next 5 minutes. So everybody stay with me for the next 5 minutes, okay? Everybody stay with me for the next 5 minutes, okay? Okay. Three different kind of convictions or flavors of faith, things that people believe. The first one involves what might be called public convictions. These are things that I say because I want to get you to think I believe them, whether or not I actually really believe them. Kind of PR statements. So somebody really close to me asks, does this dress make my hips look too big? And the correct response is, no, I had no idea that you even had hips until you raised it right now. Okay? Public convictions. We associate this kind of stuff often with politicians. Biblical example would be Herod. When the Magi come and they tell him that they're going to go find the Messiah who's now been born, and he says, when you find him, come tell me so that I can go worship him with you. Now, did Herod really want to go worship that baby? No, that's a public conviction. Okay. Then the second kind, and this is where things get quite interesting. There are what might be called private convictions. These are things that I actually think I do believe. I'm actually pretty sincere internally about these beliefs. However, it turns out when circumstances change, when my situation is different, it may turn out I didn't actually believe this conviction at all. It was not really firm. For example, let's say that there is somebody who believes that they are deeply attracted to another person as long as that other person is not available, as long as that other person is committed to somebody else. And this person believes they really want to be with that person, long as they're unavailable. And then one day when that other person becomes available, when that other person is now open to a relationship, in fact, eager for a relationship, this person discovers that they are not really interested in that other person at all. They got commitment issues. And in our society, there really are such people, and we call them men. Okay? So, as a private conviction, I think I believe it. Biblical example of this one would be Peter, when Jesus is going to go to the cross, and he calls his disciples to him. He says, "You're all going to run away from me." And Peter says, "No, Lord, I would never do that. Even if everybody else deserts you, I will stand with you to the death." Now, when Peter said that, in that moment, was Peter sincere? Yes, he was sincere. Was that conviction authentically true? No, it was not. It did not stick. When his circumstances changed, he found out reality. Okay? So, there are public convictions, things that I say I believe, private convictions, things I think I believe. Turns out, I may not even be the best judge of what I actually believe, because the third form of convictions are what might be called core convictions. And these are the things that I demonstrate that I believe by what it is that I actually do. Because the idea here is everybody has a kind of mental map about the way that things really are. We have ideas about the way that reality really works. And you live at the mercy of those ideas, whether you want to or not. And I don't have to drum up a sense of fervor about them. I just believe in the law of gravity. So I don't have to say, today I'm going to work really hard not to jump off a high building or a ledge or something like that. Because I just believe that that's true. And so I won't step off that unless I want to hurt myself. Your behavior is always a function of your purposes and your core convictions about how things are. And you cannot violate those. Public convictions, these are things I say I believe. I have private convictions. These are things I think I believe. But then I have core convictions, and these are things that I show that I actually believe by what it is I really do. My public convictions may be bogus. My private convictions may be fickle. But I never violate my core convictions about the way things really are. Now, Jesus comes along, like any great teacher. What is he interested in changing in people? Public convictions, private convictions, or core convictions? Core convictions, because we live out of this, see? We don't even have to try to live out of this. We just always live in a way that reflects this. And in Jesus, for the first time, the human race sees somebody whose public convictions, what he says, private convictions, what he feels, and core convictions, what he actually believes and shows by how he lives, are absolutely congruent with each other. Now, we come to church, and this is where it gets a little scary. The two people that I was talking about before, one of them is loving, gracious, generous, courageous, truthful, and so other one is like diametrically opposed. They both publicly affirm the same convictions. They both privately think they believe the same stuff. They would both say, yes, I affirm the Bible is the Word of God, that Jesus is the Son of God, I believe in the resurrection. They both believe they believe this stuff, but their mental maps about how things really are fundamentally opposed to each other. And of course, the great danger is that the guy whose mental map is utterly opposed to Jesus doesn't even know it, because he's convinced, I believe. There was a church in Minnesota. This one actually did happen. And they're one of the churches that recites the Apostles' Creed each week when they gather for worship. They were just switching over to computers when computers were first coming into use. And they found out when they did liturgies for services, like funerals, if one person died, they could have the service. And then when somebody else died, they could just plug in the name of the newly deceased and print out the bulletin. And it all worked fine. There was a woman named Mary who died, and her service went fine. And then another woman named Edna died. So they told the computer, just replace the word Mary with the word Edna, and it worked great all through the service till they were reciting the Apostles' Creed. And everybody said, I believe in Jesus Christ, the Son of God, conceived by the Holy Spirit, born of the Virgin Edna. I don't know. That's what it says. It must be right. We just kind of go on autopilot on the stuff we believe. And what I was thinking is it'd be really interesting when people gather together if instead of reciting the creed that we're supposed to recite, that we're supposed to believe, we had people actually recite the stuff they really do believe at the core level. Would that not be an interesting confession of faith? I believe a lie is an abomination unto the Lord and a very present help in time of trouble. Now, what Jesus is into is changing people at this level here. And by the way, somebody was mentioning earlier today this little verse in James 2:14. What good is it, my brothers and sisters, if people claim to have faith but have no deeds? Can such a faith save them? And this is one of those deals where there have been times where people have disagreed theologically and sometimes thought James disagreed with Paul. Or I don't think there was any difference between James or Paul or Jesus on what faith is. The point that James makes here is not that in addition to your faith, you have to add certain good deeds or God is not going to let you into heaven when you die. That is not what he is saying. Being saved, saving faith, is not the minimal amount of stuff people have to believe for God to let them into heaven when they die. Saving faith is that faith which enables me to live in the reality of the kingdom of God that is available to me right here, right now through Jesus. That's what saving faith is. And it is a faith that cannot help transform because it becomes a part of my mental map about the way things are. See, the way that it worked with the disciples, this is how they were spiritually formed. They looked at Jesus and they said to themselves, he's got it, he's it, he knows, he understands. And then they began to do what he said to do. They began to be in their relational life, in their humility with each other, in their finances. They actually began to do stuff and they discovered that he was right. And they began to see reality the way that Jesus saw reality. Initially, they had faith in Jesus. They thought, he knows. And then over time, they began to have the faith of Jesus. And the way things looked to Jesus is the way things began to look to them. Jesus would say things like, it is better to give than to receive. Now, do I believe that? Well, I affirm it publicly. I think I believe it. But, of course, I have to look at what I'm actually doing to find out what it is that I really believe. The way that formation works is the disciples were with Jesus and they began to discover that he's right about stuff and they just trusted him with their life each day. Until eventually they decided that, of course, he's trustworthy with their eternal destiny too. Here's what happens in our day. We tell people, more or less, that it is possible to trust Jesus with your eternal destiny without trusting him with anything else. And it's not that God won't allow it. It just doesn't work. It may work publicly, it may even work privately. People may think they're doing it. But see, in the Bible, when Jesus says, trust me, so interesting. When I was growing up, if we asked somebody, do you trust Christ? Have you trusted Christ? That was code for, do you believe in an arrangement that will let you into heaven when you die? In the New Testament, trusting Jesus never meant, do you believe in an arrangement that will get you into heaven when you die? In the New Testament, to trust Jesus just means to think he's right. Right about what? Right about everything he says. And then I'll do it. That's a follower. Is your church producing followers or just Christians? as commonly understood. Talk a little bit about, if we're serious about making followers and not just Christians, how do we pursue that? And I want to give you kind of a framework. This is from Dallas Willard, but I find it very, very helpful. And in a lot of ways, I think it might be a helpful framework to integrate what's been going on in this conference. Dallas says that authentic transformation always involves three elements. It involves vision and intention and means or method. Transformation always involves a vision for what might be, an intention and a decision, and then means or methods, practices that will help me to realize, experience the vision. And it's in this order. The vision must come first. For example, if you think about learning a language, foreign language, take China and the United States. Where are more people learning a foreign language, in the U.S. or in China? In China by far. Okay? Think about the means for a moment. Where are means for learning a language? Schools, computers, Rosetta Stone, books, the financial capacity to get help, tutors, literacy rate, media classes. Where are the means to learn a language most readily available, in the U.S. or China? In the U.S. by far. So if the means are so much more available in the U.S., why are they learning it so much more in China? What's the difference? Because there is a vision there that if I could learn English, it could change my life. The doors of opportunity, vocationally, financially, and so on, would open to me. And see, when the vision, when an authentic vision burns brightly in somebody, it leads inevitably to intention, and people will find a way. And people will find a way. But where there is not vision, and this is why Jesus spends so much time clarifying vision, you have heard it said, but I say to you, where there is not vision, then when pastors make a big deal about intention, it becomes a constant attempt to emotionally arouse, harangue, hype up, pitch up. How can I inflate those leaky tires week after week after week? And when it's all means without vision, then it's just legalism. Means without vision is legalism. And then they become an end in themselves instead of vehicles that put me in touch with, able to experience a deeper reality. Let's say a little bit about the vision piece and what it means for you and me and how people lose vision. Somebody asked Dallas this question one time about how is it so often that people, even churches, even movements, start so well and end so badly? This is the most important observation, not original with me, about vision that I have ever learned. We talk a lot about vision in our day, and it's very, very, very important. But I believe it usually gets talked about in ways that eventually will backfire when it comes to spiritual life. The vision that matters is not the vision of what your church will become or do. The vision that matters is not a vision about the future. It is not a vision about what we're going to do in the future. It is not a vision about us at all. It is the vision of God right now and how good God is and how competent God is and how blessed, how lucky I am to be alive with God in this moment on this earth. And what a wonderful thing it is that He is doing. The vision that matters is the vision of the reality of God's goodness and God's life and God's kingdom that already is. Now what happens is sometimes someone gets gripped by this vision. The Apostle Paul did. Francis of Assisi did. John Wesley did. And then out of this vision grows a deep sense of repentance and humility and gratitude and a desire to do something wonderful for God. And then sometimes extraordinary things happen. God's at work. in a person, in a little group, in a little movement. Intense devotion to God by an individual or a group brings substantial success, visible results. And then people's focus shifts from God and His goodness to what we are succeeding at. And the church grows. And people go, wow, I want to hang around this movement because it will make me feel successful. And everybody connives in this. And then the mission replaces the vision. And then the mission of what we have done, are doing, and might do replaces the vision of what a good God God is and how lucky I am to be with Him right now. And then it's just a matter of time before the end comes. Then goals replace the vision of God in the inward life. And I'll tell you how you can recognize this. Then we become preoccupied by strategies and numbers and methods. It's where all our energy is when we're talking. What's the next thing that can get me to there? Then freedom and joy and risk for God get replaced by stress and fatigue and fear and ego. And people get burnout. And the church becomes just continual heroic efforts to prop the movement up. And the only solution is to come back to the love of God, because only the love of God secures the vision of God. These are words from Dallas Willard, and I love these words. He says, "We don't need to be the vision, and the goals we set are God's business, not ours. We do the very best we know. We work hard and even self-sacrificially." I love this. "But we do not carry the load, and our ego is not involved in any way with the mission and the ministry." How the world and the church wait for leaders who can say those words. We do not carry the load. You don't have to respond out loud to this one, but is anybody here tired of carrying the load? "And our ego is not involved in any way with the mission or the ministry. In our love of Jesus and His Father, we have truly abandoned our life to God." And in this sentence, just amazing to me, "our life is not an object of deep concern." Our life is not an object of deep concern. And then we enter into means, methods, spiritual practices that have been being talked about over the last couple days, simply to enable us to experience the reality of this vision. And these are very, very important. And we need to be very wise about them and learn a lot about which ones can help. And that's a lot of what reveals about. They're always just a means to the end, and the end is that they put us in touch with the reality that the vision's about. And I'll say a word about challenging our churches, but I just want to say a word to you and me, as people who are involved in leading churches. Just honestly, is living this vision the most important thing in your life? Because no one can be a disciple of Jesus because they think they should. You have to actually want it. You cannot do it because you think you should. Now, I'm not talking about the people in your church yet. We'll get there. I'm just talking about me. I have to actually want it. I have to find it more desirable than anything else. Like that kid watching Michael Phelps. Several months ago, Nance called me into the room. For the last couple of years, I'm at a church out in California, and just have kind of a uniquely deep sense of calling there. But it's been a run for about a year and a half. A lot of transition, a lot of changes. 135-year-old Presbyterian church is a great place. A lot of challenges in trying to move into the future. And staff turnover and stuff where I just felt so weighed down. And I had great clarity. Jesus has called me to put my hand to the plow and not look back. And I want to do that. But then Jesus says, you know, my yoke is easy. And for like a year and a half, my prayer was, God, I don't know how to put my hand to the plow and live under an easy yoke. And I would so often feel just weighted down. A couple months ago, my wife called me into the bedroom. Kids were all home. It was still summertime. She closed the door. She said, I want to talk with you. She got out a piece of paper. She had a list. I was not looking forward to this conversation. And then she said, you know, I love it best when in our marriage it feels like we're partnering together and that our kids see that. The division of labor is going kind of equally, and it just feels like that has not been going on lately. Like you just have not been there. And like when you come home, you just seem preoccupied and kind of stressed. And I like it when we both know details about each other's lives and it feels like that's been kind of slipping with you. And I like it when you're just free and breezy. And she told me a story from early on when we were dating. I think it was our second date. I was in grad school. I had no money. She picked a place. We went to something called Dancing Waters outside of Disneyland. You don't have to go into Disney. It's just a fountain where the water comes up and they put colored lights on it and it doesn't cost anything. And she took me there because it was so cheap. And we were in the lobby of the Disneyland Hotel and she had to use the restroom. And when she came back out, I was just in kind of a goofy mood. And I said to her real loud in front of tons of people in the lobby, I can't believe you have kept me waiting here for you all these hours. It's our second date. And her immediate response was, well, I wouldn't have if you didn't insist on having your mother live with us, so I got to wait on her hand and foot every day. And I thought to her myself right then, I like this girl a lot. And she reminded me of that story, and then she said, just that kind of breezy, she said, I miss that guy. I need that guy. And I said, you know, I miss that guy too. And I know that right now I'm just too weighted and stressed, but I'm doing the best I can. And then this is vintage Nancy. She said, no, you're not. And she listed several things I'd talked about that I could do that were kind of in the means category that I had not done. And she was right. No, I didn't tell her she was right. Pouting is my spiritual gift, and I had to exercise that for several days. But then the thought came, I'm 51 years old, and it's like I keep waiting. Things at work will go just the way that I want them to go. We'll get the reorg. I'll get the partner that I want. Things on the book front, the writing front. It's like I keep waiting for things to happen so that I can live this life. And the thought that came was, I would rather have this life than any of that stuff. I keep thinking that that's going to make this life come. And it's not going to make this come. It hasn't in 51 years. And I must have this life. And I cannot wait anymore for something else to change to have this life. And it's the strangest thing, and I don't quite know how to describe it. It's like discovering there's a muscle inside you you did not know was there. I mean, it wasn't new information, but it was like realizing, I want this more than I want anything else, more than I want any of that stuff. So I will put aside that other stuff, and when I'm with you, when I'm with Nance, when I'm with my kids, wherever I am, I will just seek to be with God and be with that person and let go of that stuff and trust that if I'm not using little corners of my mind to be preoccupied with all that stuff, it will still go okay. And even if it doesn't go okay, I don't care, I will let it go because I'd rather have this life. And it has been the coolest thing. It has been the easy yoke. And I want it. See, it's not just something I think I should do. Oh boy, I guess I'm supposed to be with Jesus today or something. I want this life more than I want anything else, because the reason I keep doing so many other stuff in the wrong way is I keep thinking it will bring me that life. No one can be a disciple because they think they should. You have to want it. Because if you don't want it, then there's something else you want more, and that's what you'll end up going after. Oh.
Got to stop.
Last question I'll leave it with is, are you challenging the people in your church to become followers of Jesus? Not just admirers. Not just users. Are you, without apology, as clearly as you can, coming to know better and want, and then laying out this vision, and then are you actually getting to this point with people? I had a guy who's a pastor that told me not too long ago, he'd gotten to the whole end of his ministry, and what bothered him so much was, out of vagueness or fear or niceness or something, so many people in his church had never been confronted with the question, will you be wholly devoted to Jesus Christ? Will you put aside anything that would get in the way? Have you made the decision that you will seek to obey what he says above all things, or have you not? Nancy and I got a rental car in a part of the country we'd never been before, and we had to go a long ways on back roads. And when we got it, the rental car place told us, we have a little box, kind of a guidance system, and you can take it, you can rent it also if you want to, plug it in and punch in the destination, and the voice will tell you where to go. Do you want this? My immediate thought was, no, it costs something. I won't need that when I'm driving. My wife immediately weighed in. Guess what her response was? Yes, we need that box. And so we got the box, and it features... It features a British voice, because that always sounds smarter. And it was a woman's voice, for the same reason. Now, here's the deal. You can have the lady in the car, doesn't mean you trust her. To trust her means you do what she says. You go where she guides. People think they can have Jesus in the car. It does not mean they trust him. To follow Jesus means I will do what he says. Now, of course, I'll mess up a lot. I will need his power, but that is my intent. To follow Jesus means I will do what he says to do. And if that is not your intent, it is best to be honest about it. If that is not your intent, whatever else you might be, you are not a follower of Jesus. An admirer maybe, but he's not really looking for admirers. At one point while I was driving, the lady told me to go left, and I was sure she was wrong. I was convinced that this time the satellite had messed up or something. And so I went right. Her immediate response was, recalculating route. When safe to do so, execute a U-turn. I knew she was wrong. So I unplugged her. It's a wonderful thing. You can just unplug that lady. And I got totally lost. Totally lost. So I finally plugged her back in. You know what she said? She said, well, I told you so, you little idiot. She said, you think I'm going to help you now after you rejected me? You got another thing coming. No, she said, recalculating route. When safe to do so, execute a U-turn. And of course, the biblical language for that is to repent. Execute a U-turn. Because the wonderful thing about that lady in that box is wherever I'm gone, even if I've gone far, far away from her, all I have to do is just turn to her and say, okay, I'm ready to go where you tell me to go, and then she'll get me home. Always ready to get me home. That's grace. That's grace. But see, it's only available to somebody who actually wants to go home. Because doing what the lady says isn't something that you do to earn grace. It's the very means by which you experience it. It's what grace gives you, is the way home. Grace has nothing else to give. Jesus is it. He is the only one with authoritative wisdom about how to live. He is the only one to bring about the possibility of forgiveness for our sin. He is the only one to give any kind of realistic hope of conquering death. And Jesus does not present himself as a noble spiritual figure to be admired from a distance. He presents himself as master, as Lord, as one to be followed and served and obeyed. He is it. There is no other way. And the greatest thing that you and I can do is to say, I will be his follower. My mind started racing. My heart started pumping. What he has, I gotta have. How he lives, I gotta live. Whatever he says, wherever he tells me to go, whatever he wants me to do, anything he asks me to give up, I will do it because I must have that. That's the greatest offer we will ever have, and that's the greatest offer you can ever give to the people of your church. And oh man, for God's sake, don't shrink back. Don't hold back out of vagueness, niceness, fear, timidity, or anything else. Challenge the people of your church to wholly follow Jesus in full devotion, because that's why we're here. Thanks very much.